The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're discussing some fascinating science focused on the liquid portions of our big blue planet. A little later, we're joined by Dr. David Schindler, professor of ecology at the University of Alberta, to learn about the work and the uncertain future of a groundbreaking water research facility here in Canada. But first, let's talk about the weird and wonderful networks of life that exist in the deep sea. My guest today is Andrew David Thaler, who researches population structure and connectivity of deep-sea hydrothermal vent endemic invertebrates in the Western Pacific. He's interested in how marine populations interact with each other at local and global scales. He writes for the popular marine science and conservation blog Southern Fried Science and posts ocean poetry and creative writing at Hardtack and Sardines. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you for having me.
So you're currently studying hydrothermal vents, which are what?
So hydrothermal vents are kind of like geysers on the seafloor. They're cracks in the crust of the earth, and seawater percolates down, and it will come in contact with magmatically heated rocks, so very, very hot rocks. And then it will jet out of the seafloor in sort of these concentrated plumes of vet effluent. And these plumes are rich in things like hydrogen sulfide, they're rich in heavy metals, and communities build up around them that are based on these microbes that have evolved to take advantage of this vent effluent and the energy coming out of it. So what you get are these really, really bizarre communities on the seafloor surrounding these sort of underwater geysers.
Why is it so much more complex biologically?
A lot of introductory textbooks will tell you they're independent of the sun, which is sort of true, but not really. But they exploit energy from the earth instead of energy from the sun. And the way they do this is by forming symbioses with microbes that are capable of reducing hydrogen sulfide into energy in the form of carbohydrates and other essential components of life. And so you'll have these very, very large invertebrates like, say, the giant deep-sea tube worm that has specialized organs that contain microbes. And those microbes are doing all of the eating for them and then producing nutrients for the organism. So in the extreme cases, like with the giant tube worms, they don't have digestive systems at all. And then there's some other species like giant deep-sea snails that have very, very reduced digestive systems that don't look like they can function. And so the base is very, very different from what you would see kind of anywhere else in the world.
Is it pretty much standard that the farther you go down, the weirder the species get?
To a point, I think. Things certainly get weird when you get to the sea floor. Things are weird in the water column. I think once you get past the photic zone, where you see sunlight, things start adapting in very different ways because they're not dependent on sunlight, so eyes aren't terribly useful. They have to develop different sensory organs, and they don't often experience hard objects, so there's a lot more flexibility in the kinds of shapes their bodies can obtain. And they're also – it's a huge environment. The deep sea is about 95-96% of the total Earth's biosphere. And so you just have a lot more space with which evolution can work. And then they're all spread out, so they need to be able to find each other. They need to be able to connect so they can form these large kind of colonial organisms. And it's just it's a more difficult life. As you get really deep, though, life starts petering out. You don't get as high biodiversity as you do. The bottom of Challenger Deep is not terribly biodiversity rich, but the bottom of the deep Pacific is very, very biodiversity rich.
Now, your blog, Southern Fried Science, it covers a lot of deep sea conservation issues. So maybe if you could tell us why conservation is important other than potentially cute animals.
Well, I think all the deep sea animals are incredibly cute.
Of course you do.
Many people would disagree with me. Like I said, this is the largest biosphere on the planet. So in terms of biodiversity, deep sea sediments rival the tropical rainforests. There's a lot of species out there. We don't really know how the deep sea communities fit into our view of how global biological processes work. We don't know how changes in, say, the population of orange roughy in the deep waters near New Zealand will affect the populations of more shallow water fish species that we might be more familiar with. We don't know if deep sea coral sites act as nursery grounds for species that we use commercially or would prefer to have on the planet.
Now, what species are we trying to conserve specifically? Because there are some that we're especially worried about.
Orange roughy, I think, is the biggest conservation question in the deep sea. Orange roughy is a fish species. They were previously called slime heads. They're not terribly charismatic in terms of how they look, but they're delicious, and they've been commercially exploited for several decades now for seafood restaurants. When they were discovered in huge abundance all over seamounts, and we thought this was, you know, a new fishery that was just full of new and delicious fish. And we realized that, like many deep sea species, they're very slow to reproduce. They have incredibly long life cycles. So the fish we were catching in our giant trawls could be up to 100 years old. And we very quickly started fishing out the reproductive populations of orange roughy around the world.
So what's that based on, the decision to consider some animals endangered and some not? How do you figure that out?
it's dependent on how rapidly the population has declined. It's dependent on what we know about past populations. And it's dependent on what we know about how many individuals are necessary to sustain a population. But the decision to debate about what to decide as endangered and what's not is often very politically motivated as well.
And that's why you laughed, I assume.
Yeah, it's very complicated, and I don't work in the management side of things with the decisions to decide what's endangered and what's not, so I'm not privy to those kinds of discussions.
Now, what are the challenges? Specifically, why are those species and systems in danger besides overfishing?
I think the biggest problem that's come is that we don't see the deep sea. We've been exploiting it for almost 1,000 years now, and we only in the last 30 or 40 have we really been able to go down and actually see what's there. Probably the biggest threat to deep sea communities is the bottom trawl, which is they're huge nets. They've got a heavy chain or a heavy metal bar on the bottom. You drag them along the seafloor with a large boat, and you scoop up anything there. And then you take out of the net what you want to eat, and you throw away what you don't. And anything you bring up to the surface is going to be dead. The very first historical record of a bottom trawl being used was actually in, I believe, the 1300s, in a petition by the commoners to the King of England to outlaw its use. It's written in Old English, so it sounds weird, but for essentially the exact same complaints we have today. It destroys habitat on the bottom. It fishes things we don't want to fish, and it wipes out nursery grounds.
I'm wondering now, the sea level rising has been in the news a lot lately. So what kind of effects are we seeing there?
I don't know if we're seeing any direct effects of sea level rise. We certainly are seeing massive changes recently in estimates of future flood lines and things like that. But I'm not entirely sure if we've seen anything directly related to sea level rise quite yet. It's certainly something that we're anticipating will happen and will be kind of a major driver of coastal development in the next 50 years.
Something to look forward to.
Oh, yes. Well, there'll be a lot more ocean for me and everyone else to study.
Oh, you're an optimist. That's nice.
A fatal optimist, I like to say.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with Andrew David Thaler, who writes for the marine science and conservation blog Southern Fried Science. So let's talk about sharks. Now, if I thought that sharks were boring, unlike the millions of people who apparently are compelled to watch Shark Week, what would you tell me?
Sharks are pretty neat. If you were to read my blog, you might notice that I'm a little hard on sharks. That's because my co-blogger, David Schiffman, is a resident shark expert, and I like to give him a bit of a hard time. But sharks are pretty they're pretty cool. They're very interesting in that they're at the top of the ocean food chain in most systems that they live in. And they've been there for quite a long time, in some cases more than 100 million years. So they're very well adapted to the ocean system, and they're very, very good at what they do, which is eating things lower on the food chain than them, which sometimes, but very, very rarely, includes us.
How many species are there of sharks?
There's more than 400. not all of them are the kind of big charismatic things like great white sharks and hammerheads. There's lots of small species of sharks. And that estimate also includes things like rays, which are very closely related. So stingrays and manta rays and other things like that. There was a recent paper that just came out that looked at the population structure of all or almost all sharks and actually discovered several cryptic species. So I think the exact number of shark species in the world is currently in flux. And fortunately, it's in flux because new data is coming in and not because we're wiping out a bunch of species.
Woohoo. Oh. Well, what's your perspective on shark finning? Not positive, I assume.
No. So shark finning is the process of catching a shark and removing its fins at sea and then dumping the carcasses and only returning to land with the fins. A lot of people think shark finning is just taking the fins in any context, but actually it's much more specific than that. The problem with this is that shark fins are very, very valuable. They can sell for hundreds of dollars a kilogram in certain markets, and they're used primarily for one consumer product, which is shark fin soup, which is a very, very desirable luxury food in some Asian cultures. With shark finning, it allows aggressive overfishing of sharks because a shark carcass takes up a lot of space in a boat. A shark fin takes up very little space in a boat. So where if you had a small boat, you could go out and catch 15 sharks and bring them in to shore and then process them there and sell 15 fins. If you're only taking the fins, you could take hundreds and hundreds of sharks. And it's very hard to monitor. Once you just bring the fins in, it's hard to tell what species they came from. It's hard to tell what population they came from. It's hard to tell if they're from endangered populations or from stable ones. If you bring in the whole carcass, they're very easy to manage.
What are the legalities around that?
In the U.S., in almost all fisheries, it is illegal to fin a shark, that is, to land just the fins, not the whole carcass. And I actually think in most cases, it's illegal to even remove the fins at sea at all. In some countries, they'll allow you to remove the fins, but the weight of your fins has to be proportional to the weight of your carcasses. So only like 15% of the total weight of your catch can be fins if you've removed the fins. There's one U.S. Fishery, and I'm going to say it's the smooth dogfish. I'm probably wrong. There's spiny dogfish and smooth dogfish, and whenever I talk about this, I get them mixed up. But I'm going to say it's the smooth dogfish, and if you Google it and find out it's the spiny dogfish, don't come after me because it's possibly the spiny dogfish instead. But in that fishery, you are allowed to remove the fins and land the sharks with the fins removed. You still can't throw the carcasses away and land just fins. For the rest of the U.S., there's no finning allowed.
Now, this is one of those times when practicalities bump up against culture because
yes.
This is a traditional practice, right?
Absolutely. It's a traditional practice, and the finning is the problem. Being able to land huge numbers of fins allows you to kill huge numbers of sharks. The actual product is not the problem because you can sustainably manage a fishery, catch sharks, and sell their fins, provided that you're not also overfishing the fishery and destroying the species. So it's this thing where it's wrapped up in outlawing finning and outlawing shark fin soup are easy to do, but are much more difficult to implement if you have a culture that says, well, we like shark fin soup, and we think we should continue to have it. And if your only option is outlawing the soup, then we don't want to have anything to do with you. Whereas if you come at it from a, why don't we look at this in practical, sort of a conservation context where we just make sure that the sharks themselves are not overfished, but you can still use a sustainable amount of them. And that has been a very, very difficult conversation in the shark conservation world in the last decade or so, and it's still ongoing, and I don't think it'll be resolved anytime soon.
Well, so what about shark fishing, since you just mentioned that, not the finning itself?
There are some shark fisheries which have been declared sustainable. There's not many. Sharks are – they're a tricky fish to manage because on top of sort of just the realities of fisheries, there's a lot of emotional baggage associated with sharks. People are afraid of sharks. People think sharks shouldn't be in the ocean. People think sharks can be a menace. People think sharks attack people. And so I think in general it's more difficult to convince people that shark conservation is important than it is to convince people about things like dolphin conservation or right. manatee conservation, where we have kind of a more positive outlook on the species.
Well, it does seem like there's a lot of information out there about sharks that isn't exactly fact-based. And actually, yes. that holds for every topic that we cover on this show, really. But since we're talking about sharks, is there anything that you want to set the record straight on? Give me shark myths.
Sharks don't cure cancer. Sharks do get cancer. I think that's the biggest one that's out there right now is this. Well, it was huge in the 90s. We still see it quite a bit. Sharks do get cancer. Shark cartilage cannot cure cancer. And the person that promoted this idea that shark cartilage cures cancer owned the only commercial factory that produced shark cartilage pills, which is sort of an immediate red flag. So that's a myth that I think it's still out there. It's been busted pretty well, but we still see it cropping up.
That's interesting. So what did they say the mechanism was?
To be honest, I have no idea. I saw a lot of kind of new agey things and some random ads and stuff that say sharks don't get cancer, so if you eat shark cartilage, it might help you. But I never saw any mechanisms proposed. And I'm sure that's because there is no possible mechanism for how that would work.
Funny that. But sharks do get cancer.
Sharks get cancer, and we've known sharks get cancer for more than a century. Some of the earliest shark surveys out there have reported sharks with tumors on them. So, yes, sharks get cancer. There's no such thing as a cancer as sharks having some sort of immunity to cancer or any other disease.
All right. More myths.
Bull sharks do not have the highest recorded testosterone levels of any animals. I don't remember what currently does, but it's not bull sharks.
I have never heard that.
It's a thing. I think it came out of a video game. I think it came out of one of the Grand Theft Auto games, and it just someone ran with it. Because the only original source I can find is a demotivational poster, one of those memes of a character from one of the Grand Theft Auto games saying, "I take bull shark testosterone for weightlifting." So no, that is also not true.
Okay, good. Thank you for clearing that up.
Sharks don't attack people in general. To be more specific, sharks don't hunt people for food. Sharks have a lot of tactile senses around their snout and near their mouth. They have phenomenal electroreceptors, so they can feel electromagnetic fields in the water. And they hunt in areas where people like to be. Most shark attacks are kind of these sort of one strike and vanish approaches where the shark feels something in the water. They don't know it's a person. They swim up. They take either a test bump where they just brush up against the person, which shark skin is very coarse. It can actually shark skin is teeth too. It's called dermal denticles. So you can actually get a pretty nasty rash from just bumping up against the shark. Or they'll take a taste. They'll realize it's not actual food and they'll leave. Now that taste could take your leg and you could die from that. But sharks don't, in general, rarely ever see any reports of sharks actually eating people.
What about the idea of the fact that they can smell blood in the water? Or maybe that's not a fact.
That is the myth that goes out. I see even in Discovery Channel documentaries, they say things like they can smell a drop of blood from a mile away.
Right.
I mean, just a basic understanding of chemistry will tell you that's wrong. They have very advanced chemical receptors. They can detect a very, very, very small dilution of blood in the water. But it can't be away from them. Those molecules have to be on their chemical receptors. So they can smell tiny amounts of blood. They can't smell it from a mile away.
We have a question from the chat from Greg Layden.
Uh-oh.
Oh, we know. No, this one's good.
All right.
What can the average person do to keep up to date on what to eat or not eat from food stores and in restaurants?
I'm assuming he's talking about the endangered species.
Oh, that's a tough one. Specifically with seafood is more complicated than anyone ever really wants to get into because there's two problems with seafood. One is that we have a very hard time telling which seafood source is really sustainable and which is just sort of greenwashing sustainable. And we're not terribly good at assessing what makes a good sustainable seafood option. The other problem is we often don't know what seafood we're eating. There's a really long supply chain between where the fish is caught and when the fish ends up on your dinner plate. And there's several dozen steps on that supply chain to get from point A to point B. And so what happens is you end up with a fish that starts off being caught somewhere south of the Philippines. It gets packaged, it gets filleted, it gets shipped to Singapore, it gets shipped out, it gets repackaged, it gets frozen, it gets processed, it ends up on your plate. And by that time, there are so many different possible steps where you could have lost the identification of that fish that it becomes very difficult to tell if the fish that you ordered is really, say, a sea bass, or if it's a Nile perch or a carp or any other similar kind of fillet. And we've done – other scientists have gone out and done genetic tests in seafoods to see if the fish being served matches up with the actual identity of the fish being ordered. And the percentage of failures is very, very high. So even if you want to make a responsible choice about your seafood, it's often not possible to. For seafood, the best thing that I can say is buy it from the boat. And that's great if you live in a community where fishing boats come in, but it's not a solution for everyone.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking about marine science with Andrew David Thaler. We'll be right back after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm joined by Andrew David Thaler, who studies deep-sea hydrothermal vent endemic invertebrates in the Western Pacific. He's one of the writers of marine science and conservation blog Southern Fried Science. Now, before we get back to talking about deep sea creatures, I do have to mention one thing. You told me before the show that you didn't want to talk about live whales, but you would happily talk about dead ones. So,
yes.
Explain yourself, sir.
So, I don't work with whales when they're swimming around in the ocean, so I probably can't add too much interesting to that story. I do, however, do a little bit of work with dead whales. The deep sea is not a very nutrient-rich place, and so if something like a blue whale were to die and sink to the bottom, that is a huge food resource for everything that lives there. And so when this happens, you get this massive input of food, and you get this crazy series of communities that sort of come on. You'll get these mobile scavengers like giant deep-sea isopods, which are things that look like roly-polies but are 2 to 3 feet long, and other large scavengers that will just rip apart the carcass. You'll end up with a skeleton, and a whale skeleton is very, very, very lipid-rich. So you'll get these really highly evolved communities of bone-eating worms called oocidacs, which can extract the lipids directly from the bones and through a process similar to what you see at hydrothermal vents, use endosymbiotic microbes to convert those lipids into energy for the host worm. And these worms have only been discovered in the last about 15 years. And they're a very, very a major component of faunal succession at – they're called whale falls, sites where dead whales hit the seafloor.
Okay, so that's gross. Good.
They get even better than that because some of the species of oocidacs, as you can imagine, it's very hard to find a mate if you're dependent on dead whales for your habitat across the entire ocean. So some of these worms, the larger worms are all female, and they travel with harems of dwarf males. And so you'll find a single female worm, which is very large, burrowing into the whale's bone. And then inside you could find 120 or 200 parasitic dwarf males.
I'm making a face. That doesn't really translate on radio.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have visual aids if you'd like them, but we're not on video.
Okay, back to the living. Octopuses. What's their deal?
Octopuses. What's their deal?
Well, they're presented as one of the most brilliant species with almost human levels of intelligence. So is that hyperbole?
Yes and no. Octopuses and dolphins and other marine mammals share a common problem, is that people think they're one thing. There are very intelligent dolphin species. There are very dumb dolphin species. There are very intelligent octopus species. And there are incredibly dull octopus species. Things like the giant Pacific octopus, which is a huge animal, it can get up to 100 kilograms, are incredibly intelligent, up to the point where you can tell that they've actually been planning and they understand their environment and how to manipulate it. I used to work at the National Aquarium in Baltimore, and a couple years before my time, they had a giant Pacific octopus in one of the exhibits. And when they first got it, the exhibit was sealed just like any other exhibit. And they noticed over the course of a couple of days that fish were disappearing from surrounding tanks. So they went in and they put up a camera and they saw this giant Pacific octopus crawl out of its tank, crawl across the floor to the next tank over, eat some fish in that tank, and then go back to its tank. So they started sealing the tank.
So that is actually a real thing, because I was wondering
that
if that story
that
was an urban legend.
I think those stories, you now see them associated with just about every aquarium on the planet. It has actually been observed in some aquariums. These animals can get out of their tank and go back into it.
And there was another story about, I believe it was somebody had built a submarine for a large tank, and an octopus took the submarine apart while it was left in there overnight. Have you heard that one?
I have not heard that one. I have seen the video of the octopus attacking a small shark and eating it.
Okay, so what I'm asking now is, do we have to worry about octopuses?
Do we have to worry about them taking over the world?
Probably not. Okay, good. Thank you.
It's rather hard to take over the terrestrial world if you're a gelatinous invertebrate with no skeleton.
Good point.
Once you hit land, you do not look terribly intimidating. You kind of look like someone ran over a very large jellyfish and then kicked it a few times. Do we have to worry about them in a conservation context? Absolutely, because they are, again, dominant predators in the ecosystem, and in some cases they are being fished out of existence, and in some cases they're very sensitive to environmental stresses and are not able to cope with things like sea level, like changes in ocean acidity or changes in ocean temperature. They also have very interesting reproductive strategies in that they only reproduce once for the most part. So the male impregnates the female. The female has a brood pouch which she protects for several months. And then once the eggs hatch, she dies. So they only get one shot at reproduction, which means that they have a very delicate reproductive cycle. And any disruption to that is going to impact the octopus populations down the road.
I need to point out that it's really difficult for me to say octopuses. It sounds wrong.
I know. Everyone got drilled in grade school that octopi was correct. And then a decade ago, people started being a little bit more snooty and correcting the ones who say octopi and saying, well, actually, it's octopuses. And then more recently, an even snootier branch of Latin and Greek scholars came on the scene and said, well, no, actually, it's octopodes if you want to be
– Shut up.
Correct. If you want to be – super duper anally correct about how to pluralize octopus, it is octopodes. The advantage to that is that because octopodes is the correct word, octopuses and octopi is equally incorrect. So you can say either one.
Thanks for making science accessible, everybody out there. Okay, one last thing about octopuses before we move on. What is the difference between an octopus and a squid?
So octopuses have 8 arms. They look like tentacles. They're actually arms. Squids have 2 tentacles and 8 arms, so it looks like they have 10 arms. Squids tend to be free-swimming. Octopuses tend to be benthic, so they live on the seafloor. And they have their different evolutionary lineages. Squids have a hard stylus. It's almost like a backbone, but it's just the last remnants or the first remnants, depending on how you want to think of it, of a hard skeletal structure.
Thank you. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm discussing the deep sea and everything in it with Andrew David Thaler, who writes for the marine science and conservation blog Southern Fried Science. Let's talk about the really alien-looking deep sea species. Okay. Tell us about tube worms.
Ooh, tube worms. So I don't particularly think they're too alien looking because I think they're fairly common. But these, I assume you're talking about like things like the giant deep sea tube worm that you find at hydrothermal vents.
Yeah, the ones that look like more like fungi than an animal.
So these are sort of the dominant fauna at Eastern Pacific hydrothermal vents. They have a large ornate plume, and that's what most people see. That's the only thing that really comes out of the tube. And that collects hydrogen sulfide from hydrothermal vents. And then they have – these are the ones that don't have a digestive system. They just have a specialized organ that houses chemoautotrophic microbes that produce all of the energy for them. These are also the fastest growing invertebrates in the world and among the largest. They can get up to 12 or 13 feet long in a single year. So they're big and they're pretty charismatic. When you bring them up from the deep sea, they lose all of their charisma. They lose all their color, and they kind of just look like kind of unexciting blobs.
How do they breed?
They release larvae, or they spawn in the water column. They just, as far as we know, they can't move once they settle, so they just broadcast their gametes into the water column.
Seems lonely.
Well, they don't have brains, so right. I'm sure it doesn't bother them.
How about sea slugs?
Oh,
I had to go from tube worms to sea slugs, especially given the asexual nature.
I understand, and I assume you're asking about the sea slugs with their traumatic insemination and penis fencing.
Yes, yes, please. Tell me about that.
So sea slugs, and they're not the only marine species that does this. There's a few others as well. But they a recent study came out that looked at the reproductive behavior of some species of sea slugs, and they discovered that they engage in sort of an ornate penis fencing dance where they're all hermaphrodites, and so they have male and female reproductive organs, and they fence, they fight in a sort of ornate struggle for up to 20 minutes to determine who gets to inseminate who. And often they both inseminate each other, and so you'll have two pregnant sea slugs swimming off. Other times, only one will inseminate the other, and in this case you get a victor who can go off and continue spreading his genes to the next sea slug in their epic struggle, and you get the impregnated one who then has to commit resources to rearing the young before it can reproduce again. And we see this with other species. You see this, flatworms do the same thing, but flatworms are a little simpler, so they don't have a lot of reproductive parts. So they can actually, in their case, when they penis vents, they can inseminate their opponent anywhere in its body, and the gametes will eventually make it to what small reproductive organs they have, and then that one will become pregnant.
Okay, let's think about this evolutionarily. How did that happen, do you think? Or why?
Well,
maybe why?
Well, let's say you've reached a point in the history of life where we don't have discrete sexes yet. It's energetically expensive to rear offspring. It's energetically cheap to dump all of your gametes into another individual and then swim away. So if there aren't defined sexes, if either one of the two actors in this little struggle can impregnate the other, then there's an advantage in being the one who can inject your gametes and then swim off and inject their gametes into someone else versus the one who then has to rear the young.
That solves a lot of problems, doesn't it?
It does. Bed bugs do something similar. They're not hermaphrodites, but bed bugs can participate. They have traumatic insemination, where the male has a specialized penis that it just stabs into the torso of the female, and it can actually stab the torso of another male bed bug and inject its semen into the other male's reproductive organs, and then the second male, the next time it has sex, will inject the first male's gametes into the female.
Nature's weird.
Yes.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm apparently talking about kinky slugs and other oddities of the deep sea. Today's guest is Andrew David Thaler, who studies how marine populations interact with each other at local and global scales. So we've talked about a number of super creepy species, but there's a difference between the monsters of the sea and sea monsters.
Yes.
So I'm talking about things like the Kraken and the Loch Ness Monster and even mermaids. So how often do you, in your position, get asked about, like, the Montauk Monster, for example?
We have a classification of those kinds of requests because we very frequently get asked about what we call dead waterlogged possums. Basically small rodents or things like raccoons that get washed away, they drown, and they partially decompose, and then get washed back onto the beach. And people see them, and they look weird. I'll give them that. And so they think it's something strange. So I get a request about maybe once every 2 months about someone finding a dead raccoon or a dead possum, and it's almost always one of those two things, and thinking it's some sort of weird sea freak.
Now I have to ask, why is it one of those two things? Do they look like they could be sea monsters?
I think they're just very common. Raccoons and possums are everywhere in the U.S. And, I mean, possums especially, they have very strange, kind of funny-looking skulls. So if their head is decomposed, it doesn't look like anything most people have seen before. But I think it mostly has to do with them being very, very common animals. And so if you're going to see a waterlogged mammal, it's probably going to be one of those two things.
Now, there's a difference between misclassifications of dead things and – or even of live things and like a new species.
Yes. Yeah. So we do find lots of new species in the ocean all the time. I guess the best example that fits with sea monsters would be the recent – and by recent, I mean like 3 years ago maybe, 2010, the discovery of a new species of giant manta. And this was, let me just review where it came from. I can't remember what country it was found in. But basically, the locals had rumors about them being two species of manta. One very large one that travels the whole ocean, and one small one that stays close to shore and has very localized populations. And someone went out and did a genetic study and discovered, in fact, that there are two genetically distinct species of manta, one of which is much larger and travels the world oceans, and one of which is smaller and stays closer to shore. So that was a case where kind of a myth about a sea monster turned out to be true. The giant squid is another great example of that. You know, people talk about the Kraken all the time. People have talked about the giant squid, but it wasn't until the 70s that we really started finding them. And it turns out there actually are gigantic species of squid in the ocean. And the giant squid isn't even the most dramatic of them, because the colossal squid, which is actually larger than the giant squid, has, instead of where a giant squid would have suckers along its arms and tentacles, the colossal squid has a series of serrated rotating hooks.
Oh, good. That's great.
So,
how smart are they?
We haven't really observed their behavior in the wild very often, which could mean that they're incredibly smart and super, super sneaky.
You're not actually reassuring me.
If I were to be afraid of a super intelligent animal in the deep sea, it would be the colossal squid.
So how often are we finding, you know, new species in the ocean? Ones that I guess could be mistaken for sea creatures of some kind.
New species that match up with mythical sea monsters, I'd say incredibly rarely. I think the giant squid and the manta are my favorite examples of them because they're really my only examples of them.
Good. I approve of that. Thank you. Now, you said before the show that that there were movie monsters that were actually inspired by deep sea creatures.
Yes. There are actually many, many movie monsters inspired by deep sea creatures. I think the best way to start with is the movie Avatar. Basically, everything on that planet that wasn't obviously a mammal that someone had given six legs to is some sort of marine organism. If you watch it and you sit with an invertebrate biology textbook next to you, you'll see crinoids, you'll see Christmas tree worms, you'll see tons and tons and tons of different kinds of medusoid jellyfish, and you'll see all these weird things. And that has a lot to do with the fact that James Cameron is a huge fan of the deep sea. Right. And so draws a lot of his inspiration from there. Certainly the one that always surprises my undergrads is a little shrimp called Fronema, which is the inspiration for the xenomorph in the movie Aliens. It's very small. It's only a couple centimeters long, but it looks just like the aliens from Aliens.
How so?
It's got the same facial structure.
Thing that comes out of the throat?
No, it does not have a little thing that comes out of its throat. What it does do, however, is it is it parasitizes salps, which are these kind of pelagic tunicate organisms. It attacks the salp. It eats the animal out of its – it's got this thick gelatinous house, for lack of a better word. It eats the animal out of its gelatinous house, and then it lays its eggs inside this structure, which is part of the salp's body, and then swims around, holding onto the carcass of the salp while all of its eggs gestate.
I'm just kind of rubbing my skin right now. I feel like I maybe need to have a shower. Okay. Okay, we are almost out of time, but is there anything else you'd like to clear up about the deep blue before we go?
Sure. Perhaps probably the most recent and certainly, I think, biggest in terms of size ocean myth is the island of garbage floating around the Pacific, the size of Texas, that does not exist. The Great Pacific Garbage Patch is real, but it is composed of tiny microparticles of photodegraded plastic, which are in huge abundance relative to the rest of the ocean. But an Olympic-sized swimming pool worth of ocean in the Great Pacific would have a small bottle of photodegraded plastic in it. It's not this giant island that someone could get out and walk across.
And I love that I knew this because early on, when not very long after we first began doing Skeptically Speaking, I had Miriam Goldstein on the show.
Yes.
And she is brilliant, and I believe her studies are done. And she is actually one of the people that go out to research the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. So if you're looking for more information about that specifically, go to the site at skepticallyspeaking.com, and in the search bar on the episodes page, type in Great Pacific Garbage Patch, and you can listen to the whole episode. Andrew, you're lovely. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. I had a great time.
You can find the link to Andrew David Thaler and Southern Fried Science on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with Dr. David Schindler to discuss the work of Ontario's Experimental Lakes Area right after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we'll listen back to one of our all-time most popular episodes. Evolutionary biologist John Logsdon explains the amazing diversity of sperm design and its connection with mating behavior. And Scientopia blogger Cy Curious discusses some of our favorites from her Friday Weird Science archives, covering everything from the antidepressant properties of semen to smelly semen to testicle receptacles and much, much more. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
We have one last short interview about water, and it's an important one. I'm joined by Dr. David Schindler. He's the Killam Memorial Chair and Professor of Ecology in the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. His current research interests include the study of fisheries management in mountain lakes, the effect of climate change and UV radiation on lakes, and global carbon and nitrogen budgets. From 1968 to 1989, he founded and directed the Experimental Lakes Project of the Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans near Kenora, Ontario. He conducted interdisciplinary research on the effects of acid rain, radioactive elements, and climate change on boreal ecosystems. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you.
Now, you're here to talk about the future of the Experimental Lakes area, but first I want to get a sense of what the ELA is, really, and what it does. So physically, as a place, what is the Experimental Lakes area?
It is a group of 56 small lakes, ranging in size from about 5 hectares up to about 50 hectares, set in northwestern Ontario. South east of Kenora and southwest of Dryden, Ontario, at the end of about 30 kilometers of road that would best be described as a logging road.
And the project was created pretty much directly because of pollution in Lake Erie, right?
Yes. The question of that day being in the mid-1960s, was what to do about the increasing algal blooms in Lakes Erie and Ontario. And the director of the Freshwater Institute, Wally Johnson, was frustrated because he found that decision makers were reluctant to make decisions that might cost millions to billions of dollars on the basis of a few small experiments in bottles or small containers. So it was his idea that we should try some of the experiments that would tell us what to regulate to solve this problem at a whole lake scale. And he in turn hired J.R. Valentine, Jack Valentine, to head a section devoted to solving the eutrophication problem. And Valentine in turn hired me as a young scientist to find a site for this experimental lakes area and perform experiment to solve the eutrophication problem.
And you yourself were actually involved in choosing the areas that became the project facility, right?
That's right. At the time I arrived, they had chosen three sites that were possibilities. Two would have involved driving all the way around Lake Winnipeg, which was about a 10-hour drive in those days. And the existing site was the third site, which is only about 4 hours from headquarters at the Freshwater Institute. But in addition to being convenient that way, it also had better lakes. They were small. They had bedrock surroundings, so groundwater was not much of a problem, and they were quite deep, so they were stratified thermally, and some of the questions surrounding eutrophication involved thermal stratification, which controls nutrient feedback from sediments and things like that. So pretty well on every count, this group of Ontario lakes was chosen, and then I was assigned to go in. Of the some 500 lakes that had been surveyed, of about 1,000 in the area, I was asked to choose around 50 that would be suitable for experiments, and then negotiation for controlling the lakes and their watersheds had to be worked out both with the Ontario Ministry of Environment and with the logging companies that held leases to the watersheds of those lakes.
The project has conducted a lot of research, not just on algal blooms, since it was founded. So maybe just tell us some of the valuable work that, that the ELA has done.
Okay, well, at the end of the, I shouldn't say at the end, it's still ongoing, the work on nutrients, but by 1973, we had identified some of the problems with smaller scale experiments. There were slow reactions that we found in whole lakes that took years to respond to pollutants and other stresses when the stresses were nutrients. And I hypothesized that there were other problems, other stressors on lakes that would have the same sorts of problems in interpretation. So I asked for an expansion to be able to study all sorts of types of pollutants. Acid rain and radionuclides were high on my list, and I asked for that in 1973 and received the permission and had the paperwork done by 1976 when we started. Yes, it's between getting it approved by the headquarters of a national department, especially an unusual request, and then running it through provincial bureaucracy and the bureaucracy of two companies took some time. But we were ready to go by 1976. Nothing stopped us from doing background work on the lakes that we had in mind. So we were ready to go once the ink was on the paper. So in 1976, we began investigating other types of pollutants. And of course, since then, there have been several different types of stressors to lakes, some of them chemical pollutants, some community changes, some physical stresses like changing water level, as in hydroelectric dams. So it turned out to be quite a valuable addition to the mandate of the project to do these different things.
Now, really, could this research have been done this effectively in any other way?
I don't believe so. There have been some mimics of the nutrient experiments, but they've been relatively short-term. Most granting agencies only give university scientists grants for 2 or 3 years at a time. The first nutrient experiments are still going 44 years later, and they're still yielding new information. We first polluted the lake, and then we started playing with the combinations of nutrients, and then with recovering the lake, starting with the simplest scheme to recover the lake first, that is by controlling a single element. And we've been able to narrow it down to where we know that you can now control one element and control the problem. Whereas there are a lot of people who think that at least two elements, phosphorus and nitrogen, need to be controlled. Just this week, I've published a paper that concludes that the whole job can be done by controlling phosphorus alone for a cost that ranges from about 10% to 25% of controlling both nutrients. So for a change, we have a good news argument coming from an environmental study rather than the usual bad news argument.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm talking today with Dr. David Schindler, Killam Memorial Chair and Professor of Ecology at the University of Alberta and former Director of the Experimental Lakes Area Freshwater Research Facility in Ontario. Now, David, unfortunately, we asked you to come on the show because the Experimental Lakes Area is in danger of being closed. So maybe first tell us where the money to run the ELA comes from.
The money for it comes from two departments at present. Both are federal departments. One is Fisheries and Oceans, and the other is the Department of Environment. And roughly speaking, environment is responsible for all of the factors in an aquatic ecosystem except for the fish. And because ELA has been officially in Fisheries and Oceans, they've always masked this difference by calling the work fish habitat research. And as a result, despite the fact that it's caused changes in legislation throughout North America and Europe, ELA's work has always been rated low priority by the Department of Fisheries and Oceans because it doesn't become associated easily with the words cod or salmon, which are their two big interests. The reason they're interesting to those folks is that these are the things that ministers, who are, of course, members of parliament and subject to election and the usual popularity contests that happen every few years, want to show that they're doing something about these major problems. And major in this case means publicly visible in the papers every day. So ELA has always had a struggle. Fisheries and Oceans has always done a poor job of managing the project. It's been a kind of a love-hate relationship where they've threatened to close the station several times, then relented when members of parliament who knew better and the public and the press got on their backs and they sort of said, oh, well, we didn't realize it was doing that valuable work. But the difference this time is that we seem to have politicians who really don't care about value of the work at all. They simply want to get rid of the project. There are some who would say it's because the project has the potential to produce data that make them uncomfortable. They would sooner not hear about problems with fresh water. Their focus is very much on getting projects for resource extraction approved quickly. And any part of their department that threatens that approval by showing that there could be environmental problems is being downplayed. And unfortunately, ELA is caught up in all of that mess. Frankly, I would like to see the project continue, but I would like to see it outside of DFO. It has managed to keep the project alive, but just barely.
Well, are there any other facilities that conduct this kind of research?
There aren't, but our politicians have been told that repeatedly, and it's clear that they don't care. When they're told that there's no research like this going anywhere else, they say one answer that was given by a sitting member of parliament was, oh, we have an equivalent facility in northern Saskatchewan. Absolute lie. Or, oh, well, we need that kind of research going on in the oil sands. There is no plan to have equivalent research in the oil sands, and if they were to move it, they would lose 44 years of very valuable background data that has shown all sorts of problems with lakes caused by climate warming and periodic forest fires and all sorts of other stressors.
Now, do we know if the decision on the ELA is final, or is there a chance at all that it might remain open?
The chance now seems to hinge on whether another partner can be found who will take over the site. The politicians have said they will make any university that wants it a very good deal, but it's been proposed in the past to transfer it to universities, and frankly, there simply is not enough money in Canadian universities. Most of them have their own field stations. The same federal government has just cut back on major facilities funding, which has hurt the existing research stations very badly. And I think it's unlikely that they'll take on any new ones. There are some people working on a business plan. I don't know how much progress they're making, but frankly, the only way that I could see the facility surviving is for them to open it up to American and European universities involved as well. Now, the funding mechanisms are not there in the U.S. I've already tried this idea on the National Science Foundation and was told, no, they don't fund research in foreign countries. But perhaps there's some other mechanism where funding from other countries can be brought in. There's also a website with some of the problems and some of the articles in both scientific and popular press that have come out on the problems ELA is having on a website called Save ELA.
Well, I'm sorry to have you on under these circumstances, but we really do appreciate you being here. And thanks so much for spending your time.
You're welcome.
You can find out more about the work of Dr. David Schindler and the Experimental Lakes area on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, we would be deeply appreciative if you click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google Plus to keep up with the show news, and of course to iTunes, where you can download an episode or subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending.
mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan woo. I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.